Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 137, I'm joined by four retinal surgeons to discuss the November 2018 issue of Retinal Physician, which can be found at www.retinalphysician.com. Topics covered include management of pigment epithelial detachments and macular degeneration, nanotechnology advances, uveitis and multiple sclerosis, and home monitoring for retinal disease. Today's podcast falls just after our two-year anniversary of starting the podcast back on November 2nd, 2016. We've been through a lot of changes over 2 years, but our central mission has been the same, to offer endorsement-free, industry-free, non-monetized useful content on a weekly basis. And we have achieved that, hopefully, with 137 episodes over about 104 weeks. Despite several offers, both informal and formal, over these 2 years, we have not asked or received a dime for the podcast. Retinal Physician, for example, provides the articles to us for free, and we discuss them for free, as they're a good jumping-off point for discussion. As we move forward, let us know what you want. We have several potential ideas in the pipeline. These are ideas for expansion of both the current podcast and new avenues, and new ventures. Tell us what you're doing well. Tell us what you'd like to see in the future, because in the end, we are here to give the people what they want. Good, useful content. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now live at the American Academy of Ophthalmology annual meeting in Chicago. We're here on the Saturday of AAO and actually recording the November edition of 2018 Retinal Physician. With me are a few retinal specialists. Many of you have heard their voices before. First, Dr. Daniel Chow from the University of California, San Diego. Dan?
Thanks again, Jay, for having me on.
Next in alphabetical order, Dr. Ajay Kurian from the University of Rochester Flaum Eye Institute.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
I had to say Flaum, sorry. And next, last but not least, Dr. Yasha Modi from New York University in New York. It's never clean when I say that. It always feels redundant.
Well,
NYU.
Happy to be here nonetheless.
Okay, so we're going to, again, these are not summaries of the articles. We're just going to talk about things that, conversations inspired by these articles. If you want to read the articles, they're online at retinalphysician.com. The first article from this issue was Home Monitoring Applications for Retinal Disease. The subtitle, New Developments Provide More Options to Patients. Dan, you just want to tell us a little bit about like what sort of things they mentioned in this article, and then we can talk about whether we're either using these home monitoring devices or whether we see ourselves using them in the future. Dan?
Yeah, thanks, Jay. So this talks about different varieties of, as Jay mentioned, home surveillance for retinal disease, and it's always been a great idea. Can we, for any of these medical diseases, can we monitor these patients at home? Can we limit the number of patient visits that patients need to come in for, or can we detect the disease earlier from these home monitoring systems? So the main system that they talk about is the 4C home system developed by Notel Vision. And this is a device that you bring home. It's almost like a simple portable visual field that a patient takes a couple of times a week. And if it hits a certain threshold, then it will alert the company, which will then alert both the patient to tell them to see their retinal physician, or also the physician as well. And the interesting thing is that they did a really big, they talk about a really large study that they did as part of the AREDS2 home vision monitoring study. And the one thing is that it was fantastically successful in that they showed that that the system was able to detect AMD earlier, and that detection earlier actually ended up saving vision. And this is the only clinical trial that was actually stopped early because of overwhelming efficacy. Some of the other things that were mentioned were also some smartphone apps. So there are other applications in which use a similar type of home monitoring system where a patient tries to do some kind of visual perception test, and if they fail, then it either alerts them to go see their doctor or alerts their doctor. As well as some smartphone fundus imaging as well, and then discusses some of the future applications of this technology.
You know, the second part of my question, which was, how are we going to use this in the future? I think that's kind of a rhetorical question. I think we're probably going to use something in the future. I think all of us will.
Who's using this now? Ajay, do you use 4C for your patients?
Yeah, we do refer some patients who qualify for 4C home. We found that at first when we were trying to set patients up with this, there were a lot of challenges with the insurance and getting them all set up. Since then, it has improved. It has gotten easier to get them set up for this. I think that the infrastructure of the 4C home has improved as well, which is very helpful. There certainly have been some variation in how much patients like this. Some patients find it a little bit tedious to do this over and over again. Some patients are less familiar with technology. But then there are patients who really like it and really enjoy having that ability to test their vision. And so I think it is, in some ways, a way to empower patients to be more in charge of their own care. And I think it certainly has a place in our armamentarium for monitoring disease.
Newsflash, surprise guest, Dr. Ella Lung, joining us from Baylor University. How about in Texas? Do you guys use 4C?
I have not personally referred patients for it, but I do think there is some application for some type of technology-assisted AMSLR grid. You know, I think given that most patients have smartphones now, that might be more of where the future might be, since it'll be more portable and presumably would be less expensive for the patients, considering we, you know, nowadays we give them a free piece of paper with a grid on it. A smartphone would be the next step for it. I think the 4C technology has its uses, but I'm not sure in terms of current efficacy if it's really helping the patients. My patients will come in and say, oh, I noticed a change in the AMSLR grid a few days ago. Okay, but they, you know, didn't necessarily call in or anything else, and it wouldn't necessarily change the management that much because they were scheduled for an appointment anyway.
Yasha, how about you?
You know, actually, I think this sort of begs an interesting question that I think maybe we ought to talk about is when you think about the a lot of the sort of attention at the American Academy of Ophthalmology, it's the question of real-world data versus clinical trial data. And we know that sort of outcomes of anti-VEGF therapy are oftentimes suboptimal relative to clinical trials because we're not as regimented either at the physician level or at the patient level in terms of giving the same number of injections that patients received in clinical trials. It's the same question with home 4C is that are patients using this on a regular basis? Are they actually able to comprehend and fully understand all the details of why they're using it? The good news is that there's automated reporting back to the company. But at the same time, it requires a regimented approach to the patient in order to get a tangible benefit. So I really would like to see some real-world data on how this is actually playing out, and are they getting similar results to what was obtained in the clinical trial?
Well, in transitioning, you know, and that's a great subject line, real-world data, clinical data. One of the other articles was entitled Treatment of Pigment Epithelial Detachments and Age-Related Macular Degeneration. The subtitle, A Significant Cause of Visual Morbidity in Neovascular AMD, PADs Remain a Treatment Challenge. Senior author in this is Prithvi Mruthyunjaya from Stanford University. You know, in this article, I'll just kind of talk about, it just talks about looking at, if you look back at the big clinical trial data, why do PADs happen, the association with CNVM, and then looking at what the trial data tells us about how important is it to try to really flatten out PEDs versus, you know, treating subretinal fluid, CMT, other markers we use for disease activity. You know, Ajay, your thoughts on PEDs in the setting of AMD, and something maybe, you know, Dr. Rosenfeld, who's been a mentor to all of us, has talked about is what about PEDs when maybe there isn't wet AMD, and how do we evaluate those patients and manage those patients? Because sometimes we'll have PEDs with subretinal fluid, but it's not necessarily a VEGF-responsive process.
Great. So this is a great article and a great summary of an important clinical topic. You know, I think certainly the PEDs without fluid is a tough thing to manage because sometimes it does cause pretty significant visual changes. And there really isn't necessarily the best data that treating this actually makes a difference, and potentially some data that shows that the collapse of the PED may end up in atrophy. And so it certainly is not something that I generally do, treating for the PED itself in the absence of fluid, but it is something that helps explain some of the vision losses, and I do often go over the OCT with the patients to help make sure that they're engaged and understand exactly what's happening with their disease course.
You know, I think the other question is now with OCTA, you can see changes within that PD that show you a CNVM, and it might not be exudating, and that actually makes it easier to see that than before when you have to get FA. And so I think it certainly increases the quandary of whether to treat these or not. But overall, at this point, I'm not treating this in the absence of any exudation.
Ella or Dan, do you routinely get OCTA and PEDs? And if you do see a CNVM, but it's not associated with leakage on fluorescein, do you treat them?
I would say, Jay, you know, I usually get an OCTA mainly for academic purposes. If I didn't have it, I wouldn't get it. And honestly, I don't think it adds anything. And if I do see a CNVM there, you know, I think I would put it in this category of this subclinical choroidal neovascularization, which currently there's no real evidence that suggests treating these earlier actually makes any difference in the treatment course. The one thing I wanted to add about PEDs, I think, is also that we also help to educate the patients and also about expectations in terms of changes in vision, because we all know, and this article nicely discusses this, in terms of when you have these PEDs, there's a risk for an RPE tear, or as Ajay was saying, when some of these drusenoid PED collapses, it can result in atrophy and loss of vision. And so I think, you know, educating the patients, whether you decide to inject or not to inject, to give them that expectation that, well, you know, this finding, if things change, you could have significant changes in your vision, and that it's not due to the fact that, you know, due to the injection, and this is just one of the natural courses of the disease. And I think to be able to manage patient expectations and do it ahead of time is something important for maintaining the patient relationship.
I think I don't necessarily treat serious PEDs unless I see subretinal fluid or something else along those lines. I think you have to worry about the risk of endophthalmitis in these patients if you were to inject them for something that may not be clinically significant. Same thing for risk for an RPE tear. Let's say you do collapse the PED, so now you have a prettier picture, but the patient was 20/20, and you know, I'd rather.
And the RPE tear can happen regardless of injection.
That is
but
true.
In the patient's mind,
you caused
it,
it's your fault.
I mean, it's very difficult. If that had happened to me as the patient, I would be like, well, that's clearly the doctor's fault, right?
Do you guys do anything differently when you see a very large PED or a very tall PED in terms of treatment management, if there is exudation?
I do. So the one thing, I obviously talked about the risk of RPE tear. And then if I'm thinking I'm going to use anti-VEGF, I'm convinced that this is a neovascular complex. I start a lot of my patients on this anyway, but I'll usually use bevacizumab. And not to say, I don't think there's ever been a study that's been shown like one is stronger than the other, but I would be cautious about using, for example, initially aflibercept. My idea would be like the more mechanisms I block, maybe the larger chance I may induce a rip. Again, no one knows why people get rips after injection. Some people argue it's a natural history. It could it be a mechanical function of the injection. But pharmacologically, I've had mentors who have said, well, if you're going to do it, maybe go to quote unquote the weakest, even though we know there's kind of a non-inferiority there. So I go to bevacizumab, even though, again, that's kind of my baseline treatment for patients with wet AMD for first line anyway, when I first see them.
You know, there was actually a great paper by David Seraph who talked about pigment epithelial detachments and mechanisms of RPE tears. And one of the other features, we always sort of fixate on height of the PED as a metric for determining whether somebody is likely to end up having an RPE tear. But another great feature is looking at hyperreflectivity in a focal area underneath the RPE. And what Dr. Seraph's group has shown is that we oftentimes get a tear at the margin of that sort of vascularized component, presumably the vascularized component of that pigment epithelial detachment. You know, I actually sort of, I'm going to take the devil's advocate approach here, and I really like to stay sort of true to the literature, and that there really is no consequential difference in the anti-VEGF choice.
Sure.
And that's hard to say because these are rare. So how do you study a rare phenotype of a otherwise relatively common disease?
You're talking
disease?
About RPE tears.
RPE tears,
yeah.
Right? So that's what makes it such a hard conversation to have, is that in the absence of evidence, we oftentimes seek these sort of like pseudo-solutions potentially. It's a complex conversation without a definitive answer.
The great man once said, though, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. I mean, no.
I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I agree that there's no definitive evidence that supports a decision either way. But I actually am more conservative with these PEDs. So I actually do use bevacizumab because I do think that overall, in general, in terms of just resolution of exudation, just the mechanism or the onset of action does seem to be slower in patients when I'm just following them with the different medications. And I actually do a half dose if I'm very, very concerned to start off with.
So how much, 0.025?
Yeah.
You don't have a 2.5 marker on your syringe.
No, I just go in between the 0.3 and the 0.2, 0.02 and 0.03.
What we're doing does not seem scientific.
No, I mean, Yasha's
definitely the most scientific of the group.
I agree with Yasha. Yeah. You know, I think a lot of these things end up being marketing. Like, for instance, aflibercept, we know that, you know, it's a VEGF receptor blocker, so maybe it blocks pigment placental growth factor. But there's been no study that show that additive addition of that blockage has – no one's attributing that mechanism action to any of the differences between – aflibercept and bevacizumab in any study. So, you know, I agree with Yasha. I really don't think there's much.
I'd like to just throw in one plug, is that there are a insane number of small retrospective case series where somebody started on Avastin and was switched to Eylea, or started on Avastin and was switched to Lucentis, or was on Lucentis and then switched to Eylea. And they said, oh, the PED responded to the new drug. And there's absolutely no evidence when you look at larger data sets to really support that there's a beneficial effect on switching to another anti-VEGF medication. But the literature oftentimes mars this, because you can say, well, okay, this is this case report that's published in OSLI or Retina, and it demonstrates an efficacy. And so it really depends on what you define as strength of evidence in terms of, like, you know, but it definitely muddies the water, undoubtedly.
Actually, I think there was a great study, just to Yasha's point, from Rick Ferris, I think, on the CAT study, where they looked at, like, switches in medication. They're trying to say, oh, if you switch to, like, Lucentis versus bevacizumab, like, do you get a better effect? And you'd see these changes when you switch the medication. So you just assume that, oh, the on-label or newer medication was actually the switch, but it was completely random. And so really... you know, agreeing with Yasha, we don't have definitive data that that switching really makes like there's superiority of any of these drugs.
Switching gears, my favorite phrase to say in the podcast. You know, Louis makes fun of me sometimes. So we're going to kind of lump these last two articles together in the interest of time, because we went a little over talking about the first two. So the first article is entitled Multiple Sclerosis Associated Uveitis, written by one of my mentors, Dr. J.P. Dunn from Wills Eye Hospital. The other one is about nanotechnology, an update on nanotechnology in retina, with Praveen Dougal as the senior author. And I'll just summarize, you know, the MS article was very good, reviewed kind of uveitis and MS, and had a couple of real big take-home pearls, one of them being, for example, you don't want to use anti-TNF agents in these patients because it can cause worsening of their MS or relapse of their MS. The nanotechnology article is more of just a summary of all the nanotechnology, or quote-unquote smaller molecules or vectors that are using, such as gene therapy, viral vectors, and drug delivery options, liposomal therapy, the prostheses we use. It was kind of kind of lumping a lot of things into one bag, just to kind of summarize. You know, just global thoughts. We have 5 minutes from the group. I'll start with Ajay again, you know, just to go full circle. Thoughts on MS-associated uveitis, thoughts on nanotechnology, or are you good with both?
So I think, you know, just actually I was very inspired seeing Dr. Rosenfels Jackson lecture today, and he was just going through the evolution of developing these anti-VEGF.
Hashtag AAO plug.
these anti-VEGF agents, and it must have just been such an exciting time to be a retina specialist. And I think that...
Are you bored now?
Well, I think now the next wave is coming, and we have all these potential things on the horizon that we're really excited about. And I think it certainly is not in the...
Those were the good old days. Now we're just talking about PED height.
But yeah, I think there's
and hyperreflective tissue under therapy.
That's right.
Oh man, Dan, you're the.
You know, the one thing that was interesting about the MS is that you know, you worry about treating them with immunosuppressive medications in patients with MS because it can significantly worsen their course, and yet a lot of those are like standard of care for uveitis. And given the high prevalence of MS in the population, they quoted at 1%. And uveitis being 1% of that, you know, should we be ruling patients out for MS before starting them on immunosuppressive therapy? Because, you know, if they have occult MS that's not that hasn't been diagnosed, you could actually significantly worsen that disease.
You know, interesting. That's never happened to me. I don't know if anyone has experienced that.
Well, Dan, you know, there are a number of cases, and it's sort of a, this is like the controversy that exists in posterior segment management of uveitis. Do you evaluate all your intermediate uveitis patients for MS with an MRI? And there's no general consensus about whether or not this is something that we should do. We also know that TNFA and inhibitors can also result in demyelinating disease. So you're in this chicken and egg story, and if you don't have the MRI in advance, then and they end up with demyelinating disease later, did you miss a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, or they have demyelinating disease associated with TNF inhibitors? So it's kind of a complex story which doesn't have an answer at this moment in time.
What's the cost effectiveness of screening for every patient with intermediate uveitis with an MRI if they don't have symptoms?
Depends who owns the MRI machine. No, your point is really well taken, right? Like, what is the number of patients needed to be scanned to pick up one patient with MS who would have risk with this?
But this, I think you can use pretest probability and use that metric as review of systems. And really, to be very dedicated to really trying to elicit any sort of funky neurologic symptoms. But that is sort of time consuming. So, you know, Sumit Sharma, I'll give him a plug at Coli. He actually has a very extensive survey that he has all of his patients fill out before he even sees them. So that way he can be completely systematic about this process. And, you know, maybe as retina specialists, we ought to be a little bit more systematic when we see these complex patients.
Well, guys, thank you for joining me. We're going to save thoughts on Academy Sub Day, which I was not at, and you guys will tell me about for the next podcast. I have three thoughts based on this podcast. First, I'm really proud of myself and of Yasha. I didn't make fun of you for saying home 4C instead of 4C home twice. But on the other hand, I'm wearing shorts and t-shirt and sitting like in my pajamas here in the room while the rest of you are in suits. And you all came to me for this podcast. So this is great because I'm in radio, not video. My second big takeaway is that Will Park, esteemed Will Park, will be on the next podcast, came in and has been sitting and listening and judging us all for all these things we've been saying. And I'm sure we'll hear about it in the next podcast. But he was really, really good about staying out of this, out of the morass that we're here.
I'll stay out of it.
Yeah. And Ella, welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Welcome.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, guys.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 137 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal, Round, and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at RetinaPodcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Drs. Chow, Kurian, Leung, and Modi for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.